Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the CapEx podcast. I'm John Ashmore, the editor of CapEx. Is Britain a racist society? After a year where prejudice, privilege and protest have never been far from the headlines, it's a question that deserves the closest examination. So, for the latest instalment of the CapEx podcast, I spoke to Dr. Raqib Ehsan, an independent researcher and writer who covers ethnicity and cultural issues in the UK. Raqib's also a regular CapEx contributor, and one of his pieces for us was quoted at length in the government's recent Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities. I began by asking him just what he made of that controversial report.
So obviously, I mean, the most kind of pertinent thing in your field recently has been the Commission on Racial Disparities report. And in a strange, I felt like the reaction to it was kind of oddly predictable in the sense that you knew that The Guardian and various other, you know, outlets would react with outrage at any suggestion that Britain isn't actually institutionally racist. At the same time, people on the right would instinctively say, you see, this actually proves that Britain is a wonderfully successful multiracial society and that all the kind of BLM claims and so on are overblown. Whereas probably the reality sits somewhere in between those two poles. I mean, what was your takeaway from the report? In fact, you're quoted in the report yourself, one of your CapEx pieces. So you have a kind of personal stake in it, I think.
No, absolutely. I feel with the report, of what was the one of the key positives was that it challenged the simplistic narratives surrounding a range of economic and social outcomes. This idea that racial and ethnic disparities are ultimately the result of racial and ethnic discrimination is overly simplistic. And I was very clear that the report stated that there are a myriad of social and cultural factors at play in the production of those disparities in modern day Britain. So the report very clearly states the degree of geographical inequality we have in the UK. We are one of the most interregionally imbalanced societies in the industrialized world. So I'm really glad that regional inequality features a fair bit in the report. Also importantly discusses the impact of family structures. That's something that's not really talked about when it comes to racial and ethnic disparities. And it almost demonstrates how simplistic and unhelpful the BAME acronym is. So when you're looking at people aged up to 15, dependents aged
BAME, up to 15, so black and minority ethnic, as a kind of catch-all term for anyone who isn't white.
Indeed. And it's very interesting. So you look at people aged up to 15 years, looking at the kind of household they belong to. So only 6% of Indian origin dependents belong to lone parent households. That goes up to 63% when it comes to their peers of Black Caribbean origin. So huge gaps there. And I think more generally, it is really time to embrace the fact that family stability, especially during childhood, has a serious impact on life chances and personal development. Now that may be unfashionable to say in some circles, but that is the reality and there's growing evidence of that. And I think the as you said that I was mentioned in the report, I made the point in that CapEx piece that you referred to that family not just family structures but also community dynamics, being part of a high trust community that takes a great deal of care just outside their family, but also the younger people in the wider community, that is quite important, taking an interest in their progression. Because also you don't want to be the source of embarrassment in the wider community. You want to be able to tell other people how well you're doing, whether that's at school, college, university, employment. So these are various dynamics at play when we're looking at racial and ethnic disparities. I think it's really important to move away from those simplistic and outmoded orthodoxies surrounding discrimination.
Yeah, I remember in the piece you were saying that, even if you went down the shops in your local area when you're growing up, people ask you how you're doing at school and stuff like that. I mean, tell us a bit about your own background. So you're from Luton, is that right?
Indeed. I've lived in Luton all my life. Ethnically, I'm of Bangladeshi and Indian Muslim origin. And I guess in a sense, being raised in Luton, which is a working class, hyper-diverse town, I have a stake, you could say, when it comes to matters of social cohesion. I personally feel that I belong to a neighbourhood where there's a great deal of inter-ethnic solidarity. So I do feel, when it comes to the tribal identity politics, which I feel has accelerated on the left, I think it undermines that spirit of social solidarity and almost fragments the British working classes, especially in urban areas. And it's something that I've obviously talked about a great deal in the pieces that I've written for CapEx. And I do feel that it's a serious problem for the left where there's a great deal of emphasis on race, when in reality there are many other factors that we should be focusing on. I've always felt that when it comes to social policy, John, there needs to be a greater focus on family stability and less on racial identity. Because we have to imagine Britain, for all its flaws, and I've mentioned this in a number of pieces I've written since the report was published, that for all its flaws, Britain is one of the most successful examples of a multi-ethnic democracy. But what's also very important is that Britain is quite the world leader when it comes to family breakdown. So it makes sense to me that when it comes to social policy, and if you want to create a more cohesive society, maybe the focus should be more on family structures as opposed to racial identity.
I mean, what do you think? What do you make of last year's massive sort of racially inspired protests here in the UK, the BLM protests? I mean, they're clearly born of quite genuine feelings on the parts of Britons. I mean, how do you square that with both the report's findings and your own contention, which is shared by a lot of people, that the UK is, broadly speaking, one of the more successful, if not a post-racial society, then a successful multi-ethnic society?
Well, I think that just because it is one that's successful doesn't mean that there isn't more work to do. There is more work to be done. I think in a sense, to create a fairer, more cohesive society, it's an aspiration that should never end, in a sense. It's that striving to be that ever perfect democracy, multiracial democracy. With the protests, I felt that many of the people involved in the protests were to a degree inspired by what is going on in the United States. And I have made the point that the importation of divisive culture war politics from the United States is a problem for the UK from a social cohesion perspective. You see grievances in the United States surrounding law enforcement brutality, and then you see British protesters shouting at British police officers, "Don't shoot." I think it tells you how nonsensical some of those protests truly were. Now, that's not to say that I'm in the business of ridiculing those protests. I think there are improvements to be made, especially when it comes to labour market discrimination. For example, there are a number of ethnic and racial penalties, you could say, and that's demonstrated by a range of CV field studies. I've made the point that doesn't necessarily demonstrate white privilege, which is also something that I have a great deal to say about. So, for example, if there was a Black Caribbean applicant by the name of James Campbell, I would back him against someone called Andrzej Lewandowski, who might be of Polish origin, even though he's white. And I think it's the question there, it's more about the culturally distant nature of the names might be more of more importance there. I think in terms of police community relations, I think there can be improvements to be made there. So the point is with the protests, I was quite critical of the protests, but that's not to say that within the protests there were legitimate reservations. I think there were.
I just want to kind of zero in, you mentioned some of them there. I mean, what do you think are the immediate things that the government, say, could do to alleviate some of the concerns about that kind of thing, about discrimination against people on the basis of their names or on the basis of ethnicity?
I think that with the labour, in terms of the labour market, I do think there should be an expansion of name blind initiatives, whether that's the public sector, private sector, even, you know, third sector. I think that moving towards that, you know, that name blind structure in recruitment procedures, I think that that would be beneficial. And I think it's ultimately about adopting measures that help the economy move into a more meritocratic direction. I also feel that when there are racially and religiously motivated grievances, you could say, within the workplace, I think there should be more pressure on companies, firms, public sector organisations to resolve those internal disputes effectively. So, for example, if those cases were then to be moved on to employment courts, employment tribunals, and the complainant actually wins that case against the company or organisation, I do think there should be almost a register, you could say, which clearly states the company and the individual involved in those cases. Then you might see that people might be under a bit more pressure to resolve them properly internally before it gets to that stage. So there are things that can be done, and there is an opportunity to introduce more robust anti-discrimination laws. I think that in terms of healthcare, we need to be honest with ourselves. While diversity can be enriching, it does bring complications. And I think in terms of health, when you have a diverse population, there's a diversity of health needs. And I think that needs to be acknowledged within our healthcare structures. So it could be a case that we have a more localized approach to health and social care on that front. And I think that the report actually recommends that. So I think that's quite good. Because the reality of the matter is particular problems surrounding health, they may be more prevalent within particular communities. And that needs to be reflected in those local health plans. I think in terms of policing, I think that there really needs to be improvements to be made in terms of police community relations, especially when it comes to areas which are predominantly Black British, particularly people of Black Caribbean origin. And I get that's ultimately the legacy of the ridiculous and disgraceful investigation following the racist murder of Stephen Lawrence. That happened a long time ago, but that's not to say that, you know, if you just say to people, oh, that happened a while ago, you should just forget about it. I don't buy into that at all. I think we need to take a more mature approach. I think that needs to cover the London Metropolitan Police, but also the West Midlands, Greater Manchester, even Avon and Somerset, which covers Bristol. And I think there is an opportunity to involve community groups and civic associations more in order to create a more effective neighbourhood policing model. And that is where I'm ultimately critical of, you know, for example, the coalition government, which made quite serious cuts to frontline policing. I don't think that was particularly helpful. So there are things that can be done. And I think there are opportunities to make further improvements in these areas, whether it's the labour market, healthcare or policing.
I wonder what you think continuing from what you're just talking about, the report has a real kind of flurry of recommendations in terms of different groups and kind of task forces and that kind of thing to resolve these things. And I mean, I'm naturally, personally, it's just my own political outlook, but I'm a bit skeptical about kind of initiatives driven from the centre or sort of initiative-itis from the centre. How much do you think it is the role of the state to try and moderate relationships between different communities of people? How much do you think that's going to evolve naturally over time? Or are they kind of symbiotic?
I think that's a really good question, where I do feel people need to be realistic when it comes to their expectations of the state. Now, the reality of the matter is that whether, you know, however much the state does, whether it's the labour market, housing, health, and policing, the fact that 63% of dependents up to 15 years of age within Black Caribbean communities are living in lone parent households, that means there needs to be very serious discussions to be had within communities. That's what it boils down to. Now, the state, for example, it could help to fund social initiatives, which are just, you know, clearly of a pro-family character, that could even involve, you know, experienced parents leading those projects, you know, helping new parents bed in. And that could be a case where communities which are more at risk of family breakdown, those projects can take place, particularly in those areas. But ultimately, we're looking for a more communitarian approach. And I think, you know, someone I'm quite closely associated with that, the sort of blue labor line of thinking. I don't think you can just look to the state to resolve all your problems. There needs to be a communitarian approach. So it's more about empowering civic associations, community groups, people living in local communities who have a stake in those communities to really bring about those positive social and economic outcomes. So I think that'd be my answer than that.
Sorry to interrupt. What sort of organizations do you have in mind when you talk about community organizations? Are we talking about religious organizations? I'm not sure. Could you give some examples of the kind
I think so. I think for example, you do have community centers which do great work in local communities in terms of representing them, increasing health awareness. So I think naturally with the COVID-19 pandemic, I think that the fact that we have a very centralized model of governance, I don't think that was helpful, because when you have unique problems and needs in local communities, where I do feel people with local expertise and knowledge, they're better served and better positioned really to respond to those problems. So I think a fine example there, you look at the Orthodox Haredi communities in London, completely cut off from mainstream communication. That's part of their religious observance. Now, if you have people who understood that maybe earlier on in the pandemic, then perhaps there wouldn't have been such problems in terms of COVID-19 transmission within those particular communities. So the point I'd have there, whether it could be faith groups, it can be more secular community centers. I think even the sort of youth outreach groups, I think that would be particularly helpful. So, because ultimately, as I said, this is about the state ultimately empowering those entities to do good work in the common good, as opposed to the state trying to do everything.
And you mentioned, just to come back to something you mentioned earlier, you're talking about how you're a bit concerned that American-style racial politics is kind of being imported into the UK. And I mean, observing things over there, it does seem as though they are almost in a different world. Well, a very different world to us. I mean, I saw something the other day about separate graduation ceremonies for different ethnicities at American universities and stuff. And to me, it's the kind of antithesis of the civil rights movement. It's defining everyone as part of a kind of group identity. How far down that track do you think the UK is? Because the polling I've seen in various places suggests we're not actually anything like as polarized or extreme in our views as, you know, as across the pond.
No, I agree. I don't think we're not quite as bad as the, you know, situation in the United States in terms of the degree of racial and cultural polarization there. Which is a crying shame for the United States. But I do sense that when you look at the anti-racist industry or the pro-diversity lobby in Britain, there are segregationist worldviews embedded within those movements. I think we have a fine example where the BBC's diversity chief has said that Luther wasn't authentically black enough because he didn't have enough black friends. So this is the character played by Idris Elba. Yeah,
yeah. I keep referring to Idris Elba, not to the...
Not Martin. No, yeah. So I think there you have that situation. Oh, you know, someone is not authentically black enough because he doesn't have enough black friends, or he doesn't eat enough Caribbean food, and I just feel, listen, I think black British people represent us. It's a tiny part of the wider British population. So if they're living outside the core cities, then there is a good chance that their network is going to be predominantly non-black. That doesn't make them less authentically black. Indeed, these could be people who take great pride in their cultural heritage, but just for shared geographical location reasons, their networks may be predominantly non-black. And I do feel that sense of, you do hear people in the anti-racist industry say, people shouldn't really contribute to this debate unless they're of a particular racial or ethnic background. That is deeply exclusionary. That is racist behavior, in my view. The only way you can make progress in terms of social cohesion is if you adopt an inclusive approach to those discussions, as opposed to being exclusionary in your appetites.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Sure. I mean, what you're saying there also, I think, reminded me of what you were saying earlier about the kind of BAME acronym. Mm. In the sense that, you know, the term Black Britain probably obscures more than it describes. I mean, you could talk about someone of Somali heritage or something. Mm. What would they have in common necessarily with someone of Jamaican heritage?
No, absolutely.
The color of their skin. It just seems bizarre to me.
I agree. I think that ultimately you have that. There's those ideas of political blackness which go back decades. Where ultimately there's these efforts to cultivate pan-minority solidarity under the banner of shared black resistance to rally against racial discrimination in the UK.
And that included Asian people as well, though, didn't it?
That included, and it was very interesting because even back then you had British intellectuals of Asian origin who felt that the acronym in itself was giving undue prominence to people of Black Caribbean origin. Interestingly, so and I think that was a fair point. Now, you hear about the Black community. And you correctly mentioned, even if you just took people of Black Caribbean origin and people of Black African origin, there's major differences in terms of how settled they are in terms of duration. People of Black African origin are more likely to be recently arrived, you could say. And they view Britain very differently as separate ethnic categories. So when compared to people of Black Caribbean origin, people of Black African origin, they're more likely to have a positive view of race relations. They're likely to have more confidence in British public institutions, and they're less likely to be of the view that Britain has a fundamentally racist society. Now, that could be the case that people of Black African origin, they're coming from societies where political corruption are very serious issues. There's a great deal of intense social fragmentation, and there's a broader instability. So they have naturally positive orientations towards British democracy, while people of Black Caribbean origin, they're more likely to come from more stable multi-party democracies. They're more likely to have been born in the UK and raised in the UK, so their frame of reference is more British specific. So naturally, they may be more critical. they might have a more naturally negative orientation towards British democracy. So you have all these different dynamics within the Black British population. As you say, even the label Black African, there could be a very big difference in terms of how an established Christian migrant of Ghanaian origin might view British society when compared to more recently arrived Somali refugee who follows Islam. Yet both would come into a broader Black African category. And I think it tells you of the importance of disaggregation. Because if you don't take on that level of disaggregation, you won't be able to identify where particular problems lie when it comes to looking at different ethnic groups.
Do you think, though, just to kind of play devil's advocate here, do you think there's a risk that if you kind of point at model minorities or you know, you say, oh, well, this ethnic minority group is doing very well at school and they're entering the professional classes, then that can be used as a stick to beat other groups to say, oh, well, these people are getting on fine. So what are you complaining about?
Well, we live in a competitive society, so it might be the case that certain people need to raise their game. That there is just the fact that a lot of it is down to migratory backgrounds. So, for example, British Indian success in contemporary Britain, much of that is down to first generation migrants that, for example, came from Gujarat, medical professionals who entered seamlessly into NHS roles. Then you had East African Indians who fled the aggressive processes of Africanization. They were expelled from countries such as Uganda, but they were the backbone of those economies. So they had a great deal of business acumen and entrepreneurial spirit the moment they came to the UK. So in a sense, it set the foundations for current day British Indian success. While you have other ethnic groups, such as people of Pakistani and Bangladeshi origin, if you look at the patterns of migration there, they're more likely to come from rural, deprived, poorly educated areas in Azad Kashmir in Pakistan and Sylhet in Bangladesh. So it's very important to look at those, you know, those patterns of migration, how that can influence economic and social trajectory when it comes to further generations. But yeah, in truth, it's very clear that some ethnic minority groups are doing better than others. And I think it's important to have an open debate about why that's the case. Now, family structures can be quite important. Some ethnic groups, children are far more likely to belong to stable two-parent households. That's not the case for other ethnic minority groups. And if we can't have those discussions, then we cease to be a mature democracy.
Moving on from the kind of race report, I wonder, you said before you're more of the kind of into the sort of blue Labour tradition of politics, which was obviously sort of coined by Maurice Glasman about 10, 15 years ago. I mean, you look at the Labour Party now, I mean, is this a party that someone like you feels comfortable supporting?
Oh, no, I haven't voted for the Labour Party for some time. But I refuse to vote for the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. Being a member of a religious minority, I wasn't sure I was very comfortable with voting for a party that was facing widespread allegations of institutionalised anti-Semitism. But it was deeper than that. I felt that over recent years, Labour really adopted this liberal cosmopolitan philosophy. It's almost the sort of global villager, you know, the sense that, you know, you are a world citizen, that you don't have more of a loyalty to your fellow national citizens. I'll say that now, I'd be accused of being a far-right nationalist. And I think it's really, I think it's that acceleration of tribal identity politics, where all too often you have Labour politicians, they prioritise niche identitarian interests. And they neglect the bread and butter. And the reality of the matter is a Labour Party which neglects the bread and butter, what we mean by that, it's things such as workers' rights, things such as how do you create more positive employer-employee relations, how do you strengthen the rights of tenants, for example, when it comes to housing. But then more generally, you can talk about these issues, but if you really want people to progress in life, you have to talk about families and communities. And I feel that all too often that's really being lost on the left, where I think for the sake of being overly inclusive, they don't want to really engage with the fact that there are certain family structures which are, to put it crudely, more productive when it comes to creating more positive youth outcomes, whether that's school attainment, personal development, cognitive development, mental and physical well-being. Now, this is seen to be hugely controversial. People don't even want to engage with these kind of discussions. You're going to have to if you want to win a general election in modern day Britain, because generally the mainstream has small C conservative values. They do feel that one's family can be hugely influential in their life chances. And I think if there's a prevailing obsession with racial identity, I almost feel that with the transgenderism, I feel there's almost an obsession there on the left. And just for many people in the mainstream, they just can't relate to it. You're talking about things that for many, it doesn't really have an impact on people's everyday lives. And that's where I feel Labour is going desperately wrong.
Yeah, there seems to be a tendency, especially on the kind of very online left, which is a creature of its own, that if you don't think that these issues are the number one priority, that you actually oppose them, for example. So I'm very much in favour of transgender rights and so on, but I don't think it's the top political priority facing this country. And I don't think those two are mutually exclusive positions at all. But I think, like you say, like Labour seem to be just getting, often seem to have got bogged down in what to many voters seem to be peripheral issues. Mm. Having said that, I mean, let's say you're sitting in Keir Starmer's office now and you've got 5 minutes. What would you say are the kind of core things? What should be his pitch to the electorate? And we'll come on to the Hartlepool by-election, which has got a very immediate one there, but just to the whole of the UK.
I think that's a great question, John. I think that Starmer's got his fair share of problems. There's no getting away from that. And I think that some of his backbenchers are very unhelpful, by the way, with some of the statements they come out.
Mildly,
but, yeah. But I think Sir Keir's problem is that a more patriotic Labour Party would do well with the electorate, would do better than it has previously. But I don't think he's the man to lead that project. I just think it comes across as rather... I would go as far as saying that there's an authenticity deficit there.
Yeah.
I think whether that's because he supported the party's disastrous second referendum policy. And quite recently, he was still arguing for the UK's continued membership of the European Medicines Agency, which I don't think is a very popular view right now. But I think you hear Sir Keir talk about patriotism, how he's patriotic. It doesn't come across as very convincing. But that's the problem, though. You could advise him, be more patriotic. But if it's not convincing, then it's not going to go very far. But I think Labour more generally, I think if they adopted a more pro-family, pro-community message, I think that would go down well with people who believe in those institutions. They really do. But they do have that scepticism in terms of what the state is capable of. Many people who are communitarian, they're family oriented and community spirited, they're not necessarily statist in their appetites. And I think that's an important point to make. But more generally, would I advise him to suspend certain backbenchers? I probably would, but it wouldn't go down very well. And I just don't think he'd have the stomach for it. I think the likes of Nadia Whitcomb, Zara Sultan, I think even Dawn Butler at times, she's made statements in the House of Commons where she's ordered the UK government to take its knee off the neck of Black, Asian, ethnic minority people, which I think is essentially weaponizing the killing of George Floyd in the United States in the British context. This is deeply unhelpful for Labour. But Sir Keir, he has his problems, but he's also in a very difficult position. I think anyone who's Labour leader right now, they'd have their work cut out.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that there's a tendency to, it could be easy to pin the blame on him for very deep-rooted issues.
Absolutely, yeah.
Although he did choose to be in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet, so to an extent he has to carry the can for that. And agreed. Like you say, for the European policy especially, that massively cost him, and he was the architect of that.
No, absolutely.
So it's a bit of column A and a bit of column B. I think on the patriotism thing, my sort of again, slightly playing devil's advocate, is it's a bit like the Tories in the NHS. The aim is maybe is to neutralise attacks rather than to pretend that you're, you know, secretly John Bull in under that the sort of lawyerish exterior. But the authenticity problem, I think it's the authenticity problem, which is the big one for him. In trying to come across as something he's not, people perceive him as being a bit fake. Whereas Boris, for all his faults, is seen as being someone who's jolly and is authentically himself.
I think so. I think Boris, for all his flaws, and he has his fair share of them, he's seen to be, at least he tries to see the best in Britain. And he believes that in the post-Brexit context, Britain can do well. And I think that's a huge problem for Sir Keir, because he was the chief architect of the second referendum policy. It'd be very difficult now for him to convince the electorate that he has an uplifting, positive post-Brexit vision. So even if he was to adopt that, which I still think he could, even if he was to do so, he's really got plenty of work to do, because it feels like for many people in the Labour Party, including him, Brexit is something to be tolerated, not something to be embraced and to be built upon.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think one of the big problems they've got is that no one in the country believes they're the party who's going to go out there and really go out to bat for Britain.
And seek out trade deals
and so on and stuff like that.
I agree. The mainstream British public, they don't want a rabidly nationalist party in government, but they do want a party that will at least see the good in Britain. And they're quite optimistic in terms of utilising that good to great effect in the post-Brexit context. And I do feel that Labour at the moment, they're not quite in that space, unfortunately.
Do you think that some of the problems they're facing are actually less... I mean, obviously, there's a big chunk of it that's Corbyn, that's the internal, sort of Byzantine internal rules that let someone like Corbyn be elected. But how much of it is to do with a much broader problem for centre-left parties in a kind of post-industrialised Western societies, that their raison d'etre isn't really there anymore? They need to find a role, don't they?
They do. And I think that Labour's facing this problem where it's trying to unite pro-Brexit, culturally conservative, working class voters in the provinces with more, you know, metropolitan, socially liberal city dwellers who are also younger in terms of demographic. And that is very difficult. I always felt that Labour's best approach was to accept the result of the June 2016 UK referendum on EU membership and to say to young, but have a pro-youth agenda for post-Brexit Britain. I felt that approach would have been more sensible. But because the reality of the matter is, I think it's something that, when I was young, I used to vote for the Labour Party. They weren't getting in, but you just have to accept that. You know, being part of a mature citizen is accepting electoral losses. And I felt that could have been a positive message that the Labour Party could have put forward, to say we're going to accept the result, but what we're going to do for post-Brexit Britain is invest more in our young people, whether it's skills, apprenticeships, trying to provide more affordable housing. I think many young people, especially in urban areas, they're actually quite worried about levels of crime. So it's quite interesting there that maybe adopting quite a strong conservative approach on crime, boosting police numbers, that would go down well with quite a lot of young people who live in urban working class areas. So I really felt they missed a trick, that if I'm being completely honest. But as you say, this is a problem we're seeing in other countries. I think the SPD in Germany is seriously running out of steam. It genuinely has. Being in politics, you have to, part of that is think about fresh and new ideas. You know, how do you come up with innovative approaches for the greater good and winning elections? Because ultimately politics is about winning. You know, you can be as ideologically, you know, pure as you'd like. You know, being a purist, if it doesn't get you in government to implement those policies that help to improve people's lives, then why are you there?
Yeah, definitely a question for the last Labour leader, if nothing else.
For sure, for sure.
And just to finish off, Raki, because our time is unfortunately running out, what's next in the pipeline for you? I believe you're working on a new book.
Oh, I'm indeed. So this book touches on a lot of the things that we discussed in this conversation, where it mainly focuses on how the left quite often gets ethnic minorities wrong in the UK. Now, I've seen a number of people, when they're talking about Labour's patriotic rebranding project, oh, this will alienate swathes of ethnic minority voters in Britain, as if they don't have any sense of loyalty to their own country, which is actually quite patronising, quite bigoted in a way, actually, John. I'll go as far as saying that. And it's quite interesting. You talk about those small C conservative values, you know, the importance of family, the value of even marriage as an institution, the importance of high trust, stable local communities. These are values that run deep in non-white communities across Britain. And I do feel it's one of two things, really. It's either the case that they're ignorant of these small C conservative values in ethnic minority communities. When I mean they, it's the sort of liberal cosmopolitans within the broader political left. Or they're actually using ethnic minorities to put forward their liberal cosmopolitan agenda, knowing that they have those small C conservative values. The cynic in me thinks that there might be a degree of truth in that second point there. But I ultimately, the thrust of the book is that if the left actually adopted more patriotic, if it adopted an inclusive patriotism based on family, community, responsibility, and reciprocity, then that wouldn't alienate lots of ethnic minority voters. More than anything, it might actually strengthen their relationship. And dare I say, it might bring back ethnic minority voters that in recent times have shifted more towards the Conservatives and have moved away from Labour. So I think ultimately it's that idea of having a multiracial nation state. And it's the view that the nation state, that is the upper limit when it comes to democratic legitimacy. But talking about the importance of family and community, I think that would be a very effective route for the left. But at the moment, there's too many on the left that, as I said, they're pursuing these niche identitarian interests, which I think it's backfiring for the party in terms of electoral popularity. And it's not doing the party much favours with its relationship with a number of ethnic and racial minority communities either.
I like the phrase, a multiracial nation state. I think I might steal that.
So I'll be writing in some of our upcoming pieces for Catholics as well. For sure.
All right, Raki, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
Absolute pleasure. And we look forward to seeing you on the pages of CapEx very soon, I'm sure. Cheers.
Thank you for having me, John.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.